lost in the sheath.
Der Design-Podcast der Burg.
Welcome to the, I don't know what episode this is. I think it might be the 12th already episode of the Hurra Hurra podcast. And today my guest is Nina Peim. And we came across her for the Hurra Hurra festival quite in the beginning because of her book Taking a Line for a Walk. And since then, her name and her activities somehow crossed our ways from time to time, and I'm very happy to get the chance to talk to her, though we cannot meet in person because she is in Basel and I'm here in Dresden, from where I do the interview, plus the corona time, plus everything else. But I'm very happy that we can now find a chat together. Hello, Nina.
Hello, Christian. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. We just had the power pause to prepare for this podcast, and I have that also give me a good feeling on what we're going to talk about today. But first, can you introduce yourself from your biography background a bit? Because it's so difficult, because there's so much stuff, and I don't want to put focus on things that you might find interesting from your CV.
Yeah. Well, That's a difficult question, because I think the question of like identity and like who you are, for me, identity is fundamentally a position, and you're always kind of like changing that position as you go along through life. So I was born in a small town in the state of Rio called Nova Friburgo, which was founded in 1818 by Swiss settler colonialists. At the time where Brazil was still part of the Portuguese Empire, it was a colony of Portugal. And this was during the Napoleon Wars. And then the Portuguese crown had fled Portugal and then relocated to Brazil. Brazil then became the sort of metropolis of the empire. And then with that also came a process of sort of like developing the new metropolis, and also whitening Brazil. So Brazil, as you know, had been receiving floods of African and enslaved Africans to work on the plantations and on the mineration and more. And at that time, when the Portuguese crown came, there was also a wider movement of actually importing European Caucasian like whites to whiten the population. And with that, the Portuguese crown offered the Swiss the chance to actually have a free land and a free ride to Brazil, and even an allowance. And with that, they founded Nova Friburgo in 1818, displacing the indigenous population from the land. And fast forward some 70 years later, I was born there. I'm not a descendant of the Swiss. My family comes from Bahia and from Pará in the Amazon and from elsewhere. But nevertheless, that's where I was born, and that very much situates my understanding of the world, you know, as this kind of, as being a post-colonial subject, and actually understanding that kind of like very complicated, entangled mess of coloniality. And then I studied in different schools. I always say that I had school issues because I changed schools a lot. My kindergarten was in a Waldorfschule, which, as you know, actually comes very close from where I am here in Basel. Mm-hmm. The pedagogy of and the philosophy of anthroposophy, and then I moved to a series of Catholic schools. And I think I had a taste of everything from Spanish nuns to Jesuit priests, and I really struggled there until I finally went to study economics, and that was also not good. And then I went to study philosophy, and that was also not right. And then I finally landed on design. So I think education is somehow both very much part of my experience because I changed so much from schools. And I think with that, I also realized that schools are so different from each other, and they're so, it kind of made me very attuned to like the sort of the ideologies, you know. Every time I was changing buildings, I was also changing ideologies. And then after studying for 4 years at ESG, which is the Escola Superior de Desenho Industrial in Rio, it's part of the State University of Rio. Again, another little kind of detour. It's a school that was founded by former HFG Ulm students in the 60s. So it very much imported a kind of functionalist, rationalist ideology of design, Germanic ideology of design, into Brazil of the 60s, and kind of lingered for a long time. So when I was a student there, that was still very much present. And then I went to the Netherlands to study at the Heritageveld Academy, which is very different. Like, while ESG was part of the engineering department of the University of Rio, Heritageveld Academy is an art school. So it then, again, another ideology, another understanding of design. And I think by the time that I was graduated from the Rietveld in 2012, I think I that had become very central to what I was doing. So I think I already lost track of time in my biography, but nevertheless, I studied or I'm a trained graphic designer, but I very soon after obtaining my bachelor in Amsterdam, I realized that I was not quite very much a graphic designer, and it took me a while to somehow navigate and lose track and somehow get lost and find my way into curating and mediating and kind of making space and making space as a practice. Eventually, life led me to Berlin and then to Switzerland. I married to a Swiss designer, and eventually we came here. I mean, that's a bit of a personal kind of story, but it's also part of it. I had a child. I moved to Switzerland, to a very, very conservative part of Switzerland. And then kind of, you know, I think this sort of being born in Nova Friburgo and then ending in Switzerland and having these sort of like two different sides of like entangled by coloniality in a very in a way that it's brutally unknown. I mean, I meet people every day in Switzerland that have no idea about Swiss colonial history. So I think all of that kind of made me into what I am and what I am constantly becoming. There was at some point I did an MA in design research here in Switzerland. And 2.5 years ago, with my longtime friend and partner in crime, Corinne Giselle, I started a design research practice called Common Interest. We are a nonprofit, and we kind of explore this sort of hybrid space between what we call like knowledge exchange, production, and mediation, which means we make things public, kind of. Through various designerly ways. So we write, we make exhibitions, we make publications, we edit books, we organize events, we make workshops. In a way, we make space through all of these mediums and techniques. And at the heart of our practice is the commons, or like is the issues that really matter to us, which are social justice and environmental justice, and we try to do our work with always having those goals in mind. And I think that's a good little intro. I don't know. Do you have any?
I made myself some notes. One is biographical whirlwind. So it's like, yeah. Wow, that's a lot of life that you've been describing. And I'm very thankful that you took us, or took me also, to your very, let's call it a private or personal background, because it's interesting to hear, but that was basically not the question that I was pointing out, because I was very interested in like the very latter part, that when you of common interest in how you work with Corinne and in your non-profit practice, but still, and it helps me understanding very much is how you've been. I don't know if the squeeze is the right word, but you have like you have the colonial background from Brazil, and then you now are in Switzerland, in the same way. So it's like it's not a coincidence. Somehow it's been guiding you there. But and I think we should talk about the coloniality and decolonizing in design. And is that because of your biography background that you are so much into the decolonialization discourses in design?
Yeah, I think in many ways it's very important, like kind of like what trajectories and what ideas and what experiences have bring you to a certain place, you know. And I think in my case, it comes from lived experience. It comes from, you know, my experience of growing up in Brazil, understanding the reality of Brazil, understanding the kind of daily struggle that it is, for example, to study design. You know, like I studied in a public school, a public university, which is free in Brazil, and one of the reasons why I wanted I came to the Netherlands in an exchange program. One of the reasons why I wanted that, it was what I wanted to leave. It was because I was exhausted with a Brazilian university. You know, it was a struggle to things didn't work. Teachers didn't show up. Equipments were precarious. Like I always tell the story about like the time I wanted to make a silkscreen workshop, and then I had to clean the silkscreen workshop. I wanted to do a silkscreen print, and I had to clean the silkscreen workshop for an entire weekend, and I removed like 7 bags of dirt, and there were no lecture programs at my school at the time. So we and my friends, we initiated something called Design Through the Looking Glass, and we would organize and we would reach out to sponsors to get money to organize, you know, the lecture series. And we wanted to make a publication. So we converted like parking lot payments into money for the publication. So the struggle was very much central of the reality of like going through that school. And even though I would say at my time, like the teaching program was quite outdated and unprepared, the student body was amazing. I mean, I don't know if you know, but UERJ, the University of the State of Rio, pioneered in Brazil an affirmative action policy of having quotas for Black and Brown and Indigenous and people with disabilities since the early 2000s, mm-hmm. which meant that by the time that I was a student there, my class was extremely diverse. So I went through the private school in Brazil. I went to all these like Catholic schools. That's something that is very middle class. But then all of a sudden, I was there in a class with people that came from the suburbs and had a very different life experience from mine. And that was so enriching. So, but then it was also exhausting. So it was enriching, but it was exhausting at the same time. And then by the time I went to Amsterdam, I landed in a completely white department where like questions of power and privilege were really not addressed. You know, like it was a very critical environment. Critiques were actually harsh, but the question of like the intent or the reason, like why you're making design, was for me kind of, I felt like it was very absent. But then the workshops worked and the teachers were there and the students were incredibly enthusiastic about the school and there was so much energy, and it was actually very free in a way. Like I could do a graduation project, which was organizing a school, you know, whereas in Brazil, like that would not have been possible because they had a very strict definition of what design was and could be. So I think like having these two experiences somehow made me, first of all, like going to the Netherlands made me appreciate much more my education in Brazil, because I realized that the things that I had had learned there were actually really foundational to what I am as a human and as a practitioner, you know, like things like organizing events. I was actually curating, or I was actually taking little forays into curating as a student. And I did that because I wanted to better my environment together with my students, my classmates. And, you know, one of the things that our generation did was to organize the student center, like the student union of the school. So we were also like politically engaged. And then when I came to the Netherlands, I don't know. I mean, it was really amazing in so many levels. It was very international. We had students coming from Korea and Japan and a lot of different places in Europe. So, but I felt, and there were so many possibilities, and you know, you could print anything, you could bind anything. There was also, you could actually apply for money to do little projects. But then somehow, what was done with those projects, I was always a bit like, aha, and then you do this, you know, like, ah. So you, it kind of helped me to have this double sort of vision somehow, this sort of, yeah, I don't know if that explains your
yeah, somehow
that answers your question, but I think like it is, my path is very much, it's completely entangled, or I cannot delink that from how I see design today. And it is informed by those experiences of Brazilian education and an education in the Netherlands and also in Switzerland.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because you describe your design education in Brazil as a form of, I miss the English word, but there is a need. There is, it's not, or let's call it precarity. The whole structure is not suitable for having a proper design education, because everything is missing, like staff, equipment, and discourse, as you describe it.
Not quite. That's what I'm trying to explain to you. Not quite, because there is something which is fundamental, which is the intent and the student body. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to say is that, what am I trying to say? Maybe it's clear when I explain to you. Oftentimes, when people see the work that we do at Common Interest, sometimes they refer to it as like social design, you know? Mm-hmm. And for me, this very notion of like social design is something that I only came in contact with when I was in Europe, because the reality of Brazil is in such a way that it is kind of, it made, at least for us at the university, at ESG, you know, at the University of the State of Rio de Janeiro, it made it an imperative. It was an imperative, you know? And what I'm trying to say is that reality of Brazil and this reality of Switzerland, they are not separate realities. They are one and the same, you know? I think the problem with let's say, the kind of like the European experience is that oftentimes people are just blinded and they don't see that this reality here, you know, the wealth of the school, the money, the building, that reality is intrinsically connected to another reality, which is precarious, as you said, where things lack, where support is lacking, or, you know. So I think it's important that we see that these two worlds are not separate worlds, but they are one and the same. They're one complex web. And it is this experience of having existed in those two worlds that has led my practice, or that has built my practice today.
Yeah, and that's good that you turn a bit toward the term of complexity. And in your exhibition text to the Department of Non-Binaries, you write that embracing complexity. And I found that as a term very interesting, because it takes away the idea of design as as a discipline of reducing complexity towards towards like user friendliness or better understanding or even towards accessibility into something that that displays the reality of the world much more, and and just like also turning again on what you say about your education in Brazil, and that is something that is in my mind for a while now, is, as you say, there is a lack, let's call it structure or infrastructure, but like a very vivid student body. And is that related, so that there is an intrinsic motivation by the students because there is no like over spilling well of materials and room and technologies, that so there is no great comfort zone in which they can move, but they have to build it up their own. And isn't that like a very strong competence of young designers anyway? So I just turn it around. I found, in my opinion, that is a very strong competence that designers should have, like going out and doing their things in non-ideal environments. But it doesn't mean that the universities has to be precarious, so they have to be forced to do that. It's something that should come from an inner will or something like that, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can speak so much about the reality of that school now, because I am away. I have been away for 10 years, so I don't know what is going on now. I know that they really struggled a couple of years ago because there was a really long-term strike and, you know, cultural cuts and, you know, with the whole 2016 crisis. And there was a really, that kind of led to a very beautiful resistance movement within the school, which was called the Eis de Aberta, where students and teaching staff were working together to keep the school alive. And I think with that, change takes time. You know, I think change is a slow process. And when I was a student there, we had already a whole generation of, you know, the students that had come from affirmative action, which meant that the student body was much more diverse, but that was not really reflected in the teaching body. And I think that is changing now. And I know that recently they have had a couple of partnerships and collaborations with indigenous artists and designers and thinkers. And in a way, there is a process of, let's say, pedagogical renewal happening. That comes from real life struggle. And I think, yeah, I don't know if that kind of makes sense with what you were saying.
No. The idea is, if struggle is source of change, and we keep that equation somehow as given, shouldn't we not move on from that and to let's say just say skip the struggle, because the struggle takes so much energy, takes so much emotional power, and is basically it's a struggle. So do we need that struggle to come to change, or do we need that struggle in learning design because the school is so badly equipped to become good designers? That's the point
I think the question there at the center is like, who is we? When you're saying who is
true.
We? You know,
true,
I think
true.
That's a really important question, because you know, the reality that I've experienced in European education is that schools are not as diverse as you know, maybe ideally they should. And the struggle is not something that you opt in or opt out, right? The struggle is it comes to you because of who you are. It comes to you because you are a foreigner in a xenophobic country. It comes to you because you're a person of color. It comes to you because you are a queer person, because you're trans, because you're non-binary. It comes to you because of who you are. And then it leads you into your life and it shapes your life. And majority, like most of the time, it's for the worse, right? Like it's oppression. If design can be, I think the resistance comes from the struggle, of course, but the struggle is lived struggle. It's not a fabricated tool, you know, to like mm-hmm. for pedagogical means, and that's why it happens when the university or the space, let's maybe call the space, starts to welcome the people that otherwise have not entered it, you know. I don't know if that answers that makes sense.
No, that makes very much sense, and that also displays, let's call it, my privileged position that I am as a middle-aged white man from Europe have a very small experience on struggle compared to the rest of the world. So that's I'm totally fine, and I feel quite touched because that's what you say is totally true. And just following a bit my notes on that, because you say oppression, and in one of your papers there was where you've been describing the platforms like Deep Pet Design, Decol Design, Feminism Design, that there are oppressive notions in design educations. And I basically want to talk to you about what do you mean with oppressive notions in design educations?
Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it's good to somehow for the listeners to understand what kind of like a little bit the backdrop of what you asked me. So you were referring to building platforms,
yes,
which was an initiative that I co-curated with Julia Sommerfeld within Beyond Change, which was in 2018, the Swiss Design Network conference titled Questioning the Role of Design in Times of Global Transformations. And the conference always takes place in a different university of art and design in Switzerland. That time it happened at the FHNW. HGK in Basel here, and it was led by Professor Claudia Marais. I had just moved to Basel, and I went there to the Institute of Experimental Design and Media Cultures, the IXDM, where the institute that Claudia leads, and I met with her, and I talked to her a little bit about my biography and, you know, my struggles, and Claudia actually offered me the job that week, you know, that I could be the coordinator for this conference. And that was interesting because I'm not an academic. I'm not at all an academic. I have an MA, but I do not consider myself an academic because of my school issues. So in a way I had never attended an academic conference in my life I had never followed like a peer review process in my life, so everything was very new to me. But it was also very freeing because I didn't know the formats and the structures. I could actually question the formulas and the structures because they were not natural to me. And then one of the things that I proposed very early on is that, okay, this is an academic conference. There is like a peer review process, and the papers are selected. It's so on and so forth. But because this topic is so politically, there's so much issues to it, to what we're trying to bring, we also have to create another space, you know, where we also change the way how the conversation happens. And If an academic conference is basically structured with like paper presentation, etc., we came up with building platforms, which was an occupation of the entrance hall of the FNV. And then we invited these three platforms you described, Depatriarchized Design, Decolonizing Design Group, and Precarity Pilot, which are kind of like para, they're independent, self-run, self-organized, collective endeavors of trying to problematize design through, you know, let's say the lenses of patriarchy or like gender and coloniality with the Decolonized Design Group and precarity. So the idea was to create a space where they would come together and coexist in that lobby. And then they would also make a program of presentations which did not follow the structure of a paper presentation, but were much more horizontal, discursive, conversational. But this program was completely integral to the broader conference program in the sense that it was part of the modular schedule. So you could actually, you know, you were able to attend. It was not like the B plan. It was a part of the program, and that was really important for us, for Julia Sommerfeld and I. And so that was a kind of an effort to create another line of another space for discussion within the conference. And because it was at the lobby, that was also where we met for coffee breaks and so on, which were terrible, by the way. The coffee break, the whole like catering of the conference was really disappointing. I feel like I need to say that on the record because it was so bad. With that, it kind of, I think, became a little bit the heart of the conference. And a lot of people actually said that because that was kind of a lot of where all the energy was coming together. And I mean, I think your question was about like, what is oppressive? Is your question like about like what is oppressive about patriarchy within design, or
no? It's like because you first thanks for doing the introduction to my to the question I was standing, because very good, my question was that in like one of the texts to the Beyond Change a thing, and where you describe the necessity of platforms, of the platforms, mm-hmm. of depatriarchize, decolonialize, and precarity pilot. There you say that there are oppressive notions in design educations, and basically there are two questions: like, yeah. What are these notions, and why are these platforms? As platforms, as that, or also as that term, so important. But first, let's talk about these notions, because that I'm really interested in your opinion on that.
I mean, I don't know how to answer that other than to say that like design is not something that happens in a vacuum. You know, design is something that happens in society. It's a social product. You know, it's a social practice, and society is, you know, patriarchy is a thing. Right, so design. If design is in society, mm-hmm. then patriarchy is also in design, and it's manifesting itself in various forms. Like, for example, with check the numbers of like professors, tenured professors in design academias. If you look at that, and if you break that from gender, you're going to see a manifestation of patriarchy in design. And then if you look at design histories and design books and manuals of design, and like, let's say, the references to women, and here women, I'm talking women with an X, right? Like, to also include trans and other groups. So you will see that they are largely absent. So that, again, is of like, patriarchy being present in design. So, I mean, I think that the examples are endless. You know, if you look at like working class population as represented in the history of design, you will see precarity manifested itself in design. And you really can extrapolate and go on forever. I mean, the point here is that design is not something that is outside the world. Design is part of the world. And if these problems that we are facing in our reality, in our daily reality, are world problems, then, I mean, by consequence, they are also design problem. You know, it's like design is not like absent, outside of it.
And do you understand the term or idea of a platform as something leveled up so that you create visibility for these topics, like and exchange? I'm always not sure about the idea of a platform, because like when you come from there are like two things. First, there is this idea of platform capitalism that is like all this Facebook and stuff, and that you just like that the platform is in the discourse something that you offer like in a very generous way, and then you exploit everybody on the platform, and that which is, I guess, totally different from your idea of idea of a platform. And that's where I want to go about. You know, why platform?
Why we call it building platforms? I mean, it's a hard question because it's a while ago. I mean, I think it started because of the fact that we identified a lot of these initiatives at that time were calling or self-describing themselves as platforms. So I think it started with like and building platforms. I mean, it had these three initiatives. Let's call them initiatives, sharing a same space. But we also started compiling a lot of the other initiatives, and we made a kind of directory which you could find online, and we also mapped them in the world. So that's something you can, I think the website should still be online. It was building platforms or maybe something. I mean, I won't have the URL right here. So I think it started by the observation that a lot of these initiatives were calling themselves platforms, and then it made sense to use that terminology because that was how they were self-identifying. And I think it's as deep as that. You know, I think language matters a great much, and it's incredibly important which words we use to talk about what. And having said that, I'm not like married to this term platforms. You know.
Yeah, but like while listening to you, and I think that's why it's important to talk. I found an idea of why platform is a good term, because if think. Thinking it from an architectural point of view, having a room or a room with like a platform and walls, it's a very close thing. But having just the platform, it is open to every side and gives or enables people to watch from the platform in certain directions and to be seen from various directions, and from that point, I totally can come along with the platform term.
I mean, it's actually really interesting that you make that comment, because I mean, I actually forgot to mention something that I now realize was quite important. It's like, so these initiatives were like occupying this space, and there was an actual scaffolding, which some people called it a platform. So we rented, or we actually got that from a construction company here in Basel. And we used that, and we tweaked the because it's a modular system, so we tweaked that so that we could have a sort of mini library and a space for coffee and a space like a kind of a hammock space. So we kind of used that. And the idea was that it was sort of like we were breaking ground, that we were, you know, like in using this, let's say, the construction metaphor, that we were like laying foundations for an intersectional sort of perhaps, you know, hopefully transnational collaboration between the people that were, you know, coexisting in that space. And I think that the metaphor of the building, you know, like why did we, I think I remember having clear thoughts about why calling it building platforms and not to build platforms. You know, I think it's the reason why I really like the decolonizing design group that as a name instead of, let's say, the decolonial design group, because these processes are endless processes. You know, like this is not something that will have an end in our lifetimes. Like to depatriarchize, to deprecarize, to decolonize, to unmake the harm that has been done It's a lifelong journey, and it's a multi-generational lifelong journey. So the kind of present continuous is important in that sense, because it's something that you are doing and you have to keep doing. And it's not, you know, like it's a process.
Yes, totally true. And what I find very interesting is that and at the Hurra Hurra Festival, we also use the scaffolding things. Maybe it's just that raw structure, and that that is open to possibilities. That has that notion of it's quite useful for these contexts, and for building platforms, and for creating exchange as something that is not finished, something that is in progress. And And talking about language, it's also very important to state also in that point that using verbs as descriptions of activity is much more useful than using nouns as enclosed processes, you know. And that that is also in design education very important, that it's not about design, it's about designing, and something that about action
I mean, I'm totally guilty of that. I think, I mean, taking a line for a walk and then building platforms. Just recently we did Finding Feminism, so it's like I guess I very much agree with you in what you said.
I want to follow a bit your portfolio, and as you just said, taking a line for a walk. How come that you get to these design assignments? I don't make the mistake again. Nina, you've been doing an exhibition and a publication on design assignments, and you call that taking a line for work, assignments in design education. It's a very beautiful book, and it was related to an exhibition. Can you just tell me a bit more about the background of that book, and how it came to life, and what you learned from looking at the design assignments in educational history?
So maybe let me rewind a little bit. Like, I think the reason why I got that job or that assignment was because of my graduation project from the Gerrit Rietveld Academy in 2012, which was called Escola Aberta. And that was a temporary design school that actually happened in Brazil. Mm-hmm. So this, what I was talking very early in the beginning about having these two models kind of like bouncing in my head, that actually kind of, there was a loop there in some sort of way, where I organized this temporary school. And that project came because I actually wrote a funding proposal together with one of my dearest friends, Clara Milionji. And we applied to a funding that had just been open from the city of Rio. And then we got the money to organize this temporary school. And the idea was to create a kind of experimental place where to even open up the question, like, what do we need to make a school? So just to give you a very brief description, like, in order to, it was free of charge. In order to apply, you had to answer three questions: who are you, what do you want to learn, and what can you teach? The program was kind of like coordinated by me in from the Netherlands. We then also got money from the Mondrian funds for it, and with that we were able to fly 40 people from our department, from the Gerrit Rietveld, and then there were 60 people from Brazil. And the way, like, I worked with my class, because I knew what kind of graduating projects they had, and in order basically to get possibility of flying to Brazil and staying there, etc., everybody had to come up with one activity they wanted to do in Brazil that had to involve someone else. And with this process of, like, you know, kind of knowing the Brazilian reality, knowing the spaces, knowing the possibilities around the historical city center where we were going to be based, I helped shape a program. And then 60 participants from Brazil came in, and this became a kind of an explosive. We had a talk show, we had a design court, we had a type safari, we had a monastery kind of silent scriptorium, like, you know, drawing on a silent library. We had all sorts of like crazy activities shaped by this sort of like 100 participants coming together. And that was something that was, I think, quite impressive, because I think everybody was really impressed that we had managed to, you know, get the money and organize and like manage the whole thing. And then one of the persons from the department who went there was designed a type designer called Radim Peshko, who's from Czech Republic, who had been together with a group of curators, had been curating the Brno Biennial of graphic design. And then the year of 2014, which was 2 years after my graduation, they chose to focus on design education. And they had this idea that they would only accept student work. So usually the biennial people would submit entries, and then they would, you know, the best ones would be exhibited. But this time it only student work was could be submitted. And then they, I think because they kind of trusted me that I could pull off such a big thing in terms of organizational and like curatorial, like let's say expertise, they asked me to curate one of the largest exhibition or the largest exhibition outside of the competitive mm-hmm. show. And there, the topic of design education was there. They were interested in an exhibition about assignments, and then I, because you know we were with the competitive show, we were going to see kind of results of design education, like basically what the students respond to, like what are the results. I thought this exhibition, you know, to counter that, should really focus on like what prompts student work, like what are the questions, and that really led me into like thinking about the language that is used to talk about design, and that point I realized this was a kind of like a missing discourse there. Like oftentimes people talk about results and production, and even when we look historically at like design schools from the past, oftentimes what survives is like the final thing, but the kind of conversational, the discussion, it kind of vanishes. So I became really interested in this artifact, this kind of verbal artifact of the design assignment. And this was the first time that I actually made a large scale exhibition. So it was a bit like, in Portuguese, we have this expression, like, I don't know if I can translate it, but it's something like the chicken in the trash, you know, like I was so happy, you know, like I could do, like, because an exhibition is so exciting. You can actually do so, we can explore so many formats, you know. So this exhibition had everything. It had videos, it had sound pieces, it had murals, large scale paint, like it's really a historical object, facsimile, you name objects, and like it had, I felt it was a little bit like an explosion, and that I just want to so in order to work on the sort of scenography of the exhibition, I teamed up with Emilia Bergmark, mm-hmm. who is an artist, Swedish artist, who studied with me at Rietveld, and then with Corinne, who wrote all the kind of, let's say, little caption text and sort of like gave a bit of a structure in terms of language, also for the catalog, for the exhibition. And the three of us presented together, we gave a presentation together in the sort of symposium of the biennial. And just to describe, like, the exhibition was, as I said, many different mediums, but there were four rooms filled with assignments, and the assignments that had been collected through an open call, they were organized in like a cadency or like a step-by-step of, let's say, form assignments, context assignments, and meta assignments. So of course, like design, an assignment about typography or form is also an assignment about content and vice versa. So it was a bit tricky, but the idea was that you would move from like very formal things into more like content, into sort of the contextual nature of the work, like who is doing, how do you collaborate, into actually assignments that question the very nature of education. And that kind of, it was like the assignments were like big, large sheets of paper pinned to the walls with kind of giant pins. That we had made, and then they were always translated in Czech and English, And thereby they had to be kind of edited to somehow fit the space. And the idea was to create a sort of like Alice in Wonderland, you know, like you're too small, there's too many assignments, you're lost in that room, you have to kind of move your head around to find your way. And that was also my take on education. You have to find your own way. You have to choose what you believe in and what you have to take what is necessary. And that's something that I learned from having gone through these many different, you know, educational experiences. So it was a bit about getting lost and finding your own way. And then when we made this presentation at the end, already by the time the exhibition had opened, so many people were asking about a catalog. And then it kind of became that the three of us on stage decided to take on that project together. So I just wanted to actually clarify from the beginning, the Taking a Line for a Walk is actually a work by Emilia, Corinne, and I together. As co-conceivers of it, and I'm Mita and I are editors, and Corinne wrote a text, also largely based on a lot of the materials that were in the exhibition as well.
Where did you get all these assignments from? You said open call, but who's been sending what?
That was an open call for that was the first one for the exhibition, which was circulated by the biennial. By myself through like our network, and because of that it was still very much largely European educators who responded, because that was the audience of this biennial. For the book we tried to break that a little bit, and we did a second open call, but still like because of the network of our publisher at the time, again we had mostly European North American designers, educators contributing to it. So that's kind of like what the content of the book is. Mm. Yeah.
And from looking at all these assignments, what did you learn about design education? What is a pit hole that everybody jumps in and that is always visible, or what is something that is like, what is your key learning from that? What could be a key learning for everybody when getting this book to hand?
I mean, we chose to end the book with this assignment, which I think is called assignment, or which is like, I think it's something like take any of the 223 assignments in this book and then change it to make it your own. And I think that's kind of the lesson for me, even though I think it's like, I see like assignments as this sort of, or the language of instruction as something extremely important that we need to think about. What do we talk when we talk about design? How do we talk? Who is talking? You know, that's something that is extremely, like it's extremely important to talk up to discuss and to be lucid about. But at the end of the day, it's also about taking control of your own path. And it's also about finding your own way, you know? And I think we have agency, or like we as lifelong students can have agency and should seek agency into shaping our own realities. And that means sometimes changing the assignment. That sometimes means changing the institutions, you know?
Very good. Because that is something that, that I'm doing with my students as well. We don't call it assignment and reassignment. We call it brief and rebrief. So we give the students, let's say, the assignments, and they see the assignment. They try to understand what everything is all about. Then we have 2 weeks of where we have a workshop where we just like dance around the topic a bit to see to get the wider scope of what everything is about, and then. Okay, then we have the assignment. Write us a rebrief. How do you understand that task or assignment for yourself? Like, what is what you want to do? What, like, if you would address that assignment to yourself, how would it look like? And then usually, like in 95% of the time, it's great. People come up with a personal and individual understanding of the topic and on the issues, and propose some sort of own take on the topic. And then from that part on, and if we take and if we accept that reassignment, we do not talk about a task or an action that comes from an external person, like for example me as a professor or us as a team, but from the person itself. And then it's something that, as you said, agency, it's about their own agency and their own imperative of how to move on. And I think that's a mm-hmm. that's a good that's basically that's a good way to encourage people to work for this, like through for themselves and not for somebody mm-hmm. else, and doing the and appropriating the task mm-hmm. through mm-hmm. inner or through designerly actions in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and having that, keep going on design education, you also have that project called, or it's more or less a course called Objects of Interest. And I found mm-hmm. that really interesting because in this project, you encourage students, or you assign students, if we stay in that wording, to detect, let's call it objects or designerly artifacts of guilt or that are causing harm to society. And I like the way that you address it as a research project, which is more like an like you know it from a TV series, like from a homicide department. Okay, well, there's this suspect, and we have to follow it and check if he or she or mm-hmm. it in this way is guilty or not. How was the experience with this sort of mm-hmm. method of applied, not it's not applied design history, it's applied design critique or applied design theory?
Yeah. So just to give you a little bit of a context, so this was a semester long course that Corinne and I gave at ESAD, which is a Ecole Supérieure d'Art Décoratif in Valence in France. So it's a really, it's like a very extended period of time. It's like several weeks. And just to, the assignment was that students were supposed to pick a crime. And of course we discussed with them what was a crime and what we meant by crime. We were not meaning crime in a kind of literal sense of the word as like a homicide or, you know, but in a social crime or environmental crime. And we discussed that extensively. And then they had to pick a suspect. And the rule was the suspects should not be humans. They had to be products of design.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, we also kind of, it also gave us a space to expand our definition of design. You know, like what is design? Is design what designers do? Is design necessarily like something that is, you know, so that really was a space for a conversation. And then each of them chose a suspect, and through the semester they had to basically build a case, which means they had to find proof, they have mm-hmm. to find arguments to kind of build a case and like prosecute that object of interest in, let's say, a court. Like, but and with that we wanted them to engage in a self-driven research. So depending on the suspect and depending on the case they studied, some of them ventured into interviewing specialists, some of them did analyze a sort of a corpus of elements. Others like looked into existing research. Others, you know, so each case actually asked for a different set of like methodologies or techniques on to build a case. And this is something that is really important to us, that research is self-driven. And it's not, because from our experience, also, oftentimes when design research is introduced, it's often through the gaze of, let's say, design methodology, which sometimes obscures, you know, for us, like the intent, like what do you want to do with that research? And we also always center the sort of the politics of that research. What does it mean for you to be prosecuting that object? For you as with your positionality, with your perspective, what does it mean for you to do that, to ask that question? So, and then the students, a lot of them, it wasn't like, we didn't ask them to write, but we asked them to produce videos, but because they had to make screenplays for their videos, they ended up writing. So they actually wrote amazing essays, they made videos, and then all became an exhibition. And this process is almost like formation to common interest. So common interest is also Corinne and I are discussing what our practice and what it could become at the same time as we're doing this workshop. And by the time that we finished the semester, that's when we launched Common Interest. We bought a cake, and then we each paid like half of the cake, and then we shared a cake with our students. This was like our founding mission. And since then, we always have a cake in every one of our anniversaries. And I think that's a little bit in a nutshell, like kind of what we were trying to achieve with that project. I should also say that this is also happening at the same time as I am working as a coordinator for Beyond Change. So I'm also taking a lot of the things that I'm reading and I'm thinking, let's say curatorially for building platforms, into that class as well. And since we started Common Interest, we also should say neither Corinne nor I are affiliated to any university, so we don't teach on a regular basis, but we sometimes are invited to give workshops here and there. We're going to do a workshop soon in Geneva, and we were teaching at Hyperwerk earlier this year. So we are always somehow engaged in some sort of like teaching, but never as part of an institution. And what we have been, let's say, noticing ever since we started Common Interest, we actually started getting messages from students who are doing projects like Objects of Interest. You know, they are like in their MAs or the theses. They are looking at the politics of design, and they're looking at how design is complicit with crimes, with social crimes, environmental crimes. And the fact that they are doing this research, or they're looking, for example, at how design is implicated in racism, or how design is implicated in patriarchy, like we were saying earlier, oftentimes creates a backlash. So they are in the institutions where they're working, and when they start voicing up these questions, because that kind of leads them into a path of questioning the curriculum, questioning the canon, questioning the theory that they've been given, questioning even the teacher who is actually, you know, maybe being their mentor. So we started receiving these emails, and like in recent, I think since a year, they have become quite frequent. I could almost say that we get one at least once a week. We call them like the lost souls, and they are usually like struggling to pursue their research. They are really they want support, they want guidance. We always Skype with them. We always find time to have a conversation with them, and we realize that all they need is support. They need a space where they are allowed to bring these questions without the backlash, you know, because the questions are so valid, they're so necessary, but they're oftentimes being shut down. So we, after like many months and of actually receiving those, we came up with something which we are now calling the Troublemakers Class of 2020, which is in a way a follow-up to Objects of Interest, but it's sort of a decentralized classroom, or like a, not even a classroom, a workshop space. So the idea is that participants bring their research with them to that space, and the space becomes a community space where they can have conversations, they can share resources, they can actually explore their topics in a safer environment, in an environment where, you know, asking those hard, difficult questions isn't, you know, does not, you know, lead to a backlash. And this is something that maybe I have to kind of go back like three steps. This is something that we have now conceiving as part of Futures, which is a new magazine and community space for design research. Mm-hmm. We, Corinne and I, founded with Madeleine Morley, British journalist Madeleine Morley. And we are kind of in the process of building right now. So the idea is that, you know, stories, those missing stories, those marginalized stories, those stories about the struggles, design, putting the design at the center of struggles, we need to find a home for those stories to thrive. And so that's why we envision a space which is at the same time a kind of a publishing platform, so where the stories can appear, but at the same time a kind of a workshop community space where people can come together and share and explore those subjects together. This is very much a consequence of a workshop Maddie, Corinne, and I did in April and May, together with Le Signe, which is a French institution for graphic design. Mm-hmm. They asked us to do a workshop, and we proposed the Liberation in Print Collective. At the time, we were researching a lot about the history of feminist periodicals, and this was in the really at the height of the lockdown here in Switzerland. So we realized that there's so much material in like archivist archives about feminist periodicals. So this would be something that we could do, a research that we could do during the time of the lockdown. And then this was a really an amazing experience. We brought together a group of participants, of 23 participants from Melbourne to LA via Dubai and beyond. And we met every Wednesday to like discuss, and it really became a kind of like a safer space for us to share that common interest and to really grow and learn from each other. And at the end, each participant produced a text. And those texts were bundled together in a publication called Feminist Findings. And it also became an exhibition at a space in Berlin called A to Z. Mm-hmm. In Torstrasse, and it's still on display, so you can still see it if you're in Berlin until, like, I think the 24th of September. So yeah, this process of like running this collective workshop, collective design research workshop, where we were one team with people doing self-driven research, you know, and then coming back to the group on projects that are of like socially driven and also like politically implicated and situated and affected and positioned, you know, that is kind of the energy that we want to bring into Futurist. I don't know. I think I drifted a little bit. Sorry.
Yeah, but it's very joyful to listen you drifting. So because you come up with so many other things like Futurist, and also that in my eyes is very important that you are open to people reaching out to you, and that there is a visceral demand on exchange about these problems that people or that young people in design departments get blocked from changing things, and that is really interesting. And like while listening to you, and I think it might happen to some other listeners as well, I found immediately examples of like students of mine that have problems getting their like ambitious projects through the commissions and all that stuff. And that is really a thing that starts to encourage me to empower these more. Mm-hmm. That it's much more to letting the students doing it, because to be honest, sometimes I think that it's enough, because I will not patronize them too much because I would just like pour over my expectations and my what I would do over them, so I would just let them go more for themselves. But I think it's more support from the structural side necessary, what I am part of. So look, they are coming up with something really interesting. Should let them do, but let's also keep a part of the work on our side, because it's not that they come from nothing. So there is a demand, there is something that is visible to them that they want to have changed. And shame on us that the students had to come and it's not us as a structure to do so. But it will be the last question, because we are quite good in the time, but as common interest, and that is really interesting to me as also a design practitioner. You call yourself like a non-profit design research space or platform. How do you manage to stay non-profit in a way?
Well, to stay nonprofit, I mean, that's
to be nonprofit. Like, where do you start?
We are a Verein. I mean, nonprofit doesn't mean that we don't pay ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we pay ourselves salaries. And we also have a commitment to each other that we've been trying. We started very precarious back in 2018. And we have a commitment to each other that we try to every 6 months up our salaries. And we are still precarious, but livable. I think this is also something that we're also always very open about, our finances and how we finance our practice, because we by no means we want to mystify, you know, that what mm-hmm. we do is it's really hard work and it's challenging in many levels. So we are a nonprofit because we are a Verein, and that's one of the it's a simple legal structure here in Switzerland. Mm. It's also because we are, we depend a lot on cultural funding, and we also fundraise a lot for projects. So some of our projects are commissions, some of our projects are teaching assignments, some of our projects are maybe even more like actually still a few more classical design jobs that we take because we need to cross-finance our practice, but less and less. We've been taking on those. Nevertheless, being a nonprofit, it's a good position because we need to fundraise regularly. And as a GmbH or pro-profit mm-hmm. legal institution in Switzerland, you're not. There are several of these foundations which all of a sudden you're also not eligible anymore. Mm-hmm. So I want to be clear about that. We are nonprofit, not in the sense that we do this pro bono work. We pay ourselves, and we also pay everyone that works with us a fair salary. This is the reason why we very seldomly take on interns, because we're absolutely against the practice of like underpaying or exploiting interns in any way. We're very vocal about that. And everybody with whom we collaborate, we always offer at least the same salary that we get, that we pay ourselves. That's part of like how we work.
Yeah, very good. That's very clearing. So being nonprofit doesn't mean you have to work for free.
No, absolutely. No. Labor is labor. Labor has to be remunerated. All forms of labor should be remunerated. Mm-hmm. I'm very much, believer in that.
So there's also one in my notes, there's this one big four-letter word called care, because when you talk about all labor should be like, I can't recall, remunerated, or which I understand as paid and mm-hmm. Appreciated in a financial way. So but I think this is a discussion we should move on for later. Nina, thanks a lot for all these insights. As you said before, you talk a lot. I just saw myself just to give you some sort of like pings, and then you just like keep going, and don't feel bad about it. It's very refreshing. It's very insightful, and for me as a listener to you right now, it also started to trigger a lot of questions and a lot of re-questioning things that I take for granted or that I took for pretty common because they are normal. But like as you said, re-questioning what is we, it's also what is normal. And for that, just now, thank you very much. And,
Do you
have something as a last remark to say that you think, oh, well, Christian had a lot of questions, but this is unquestioned and by this unanswered?
No, I think we talked about a lot of different things. I think let's just hope the conversation will continue.
Yes.
I think that's the whole point, you know, to stay in the present continuous.
Yes, and I think we will have it. So because as I now know that you are able to travel, let's wait a bit the corona thing, and Burghalle is always an open place for you. So
let's
see where this goes.
All right.
Cool. Thank you. Ciao.
Bye. Ciao, ciao. Oh.
Der Design-Podcast der Burg.